It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll preview a Christmas play that's using a sensory-friendly model to help kids with autism enjoy the show. First, leaders from the cities of Milwaukee and Waukesha have signed a 40-year contract that would allow Milwaukee to sell water from Lake Michigan to Waukesha. Here's Waukesha Mayor Sean Riley.
Our cities are both urban hubs of their counties, and we have many interests in common. This agreement is truly a win-win for both communities.
Waukesha has been in the process of requesting drinking water from the Great Lakes for a number of years now because its own drinking water is contaminated. That request became an international issue since the city isn't part of the Great Lakes Basin. Chuck Krumbach is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He's based in Milwaukee. He's been following this story for a good long while. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
What is in this deal that was just signed this week?
Well, as you mentioned, it's 40 years of Milwaukee Water Works selling Lake Michigan water to Waukesha. So a lot of water will go west, up to 6, maybe 8 million gallons of water a day eventually. And going east will be a lot of money, up to $42 million in revenue for Milwaukee for at least the first 20 years, maybe more eventually than that as time goes on.
And it looked for a while like Waukesha would not be getting it from Milwaukee, but I think Oak Creek, what ended up happening there?
That's right. There was a discussions between Waukesha and Oak Creek that went on for some time. Then last summer, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett proposed this idea of Milwaukee selling it. It had been discussed loosely before, but when the Great Lakes governors cut back the size of the service area that Waukesha wanted to serve with this lake water, and therefore Milwaukee was more comfortable that this water wouldn't just go to fuel a lot of development in Waukesha County. Milwaukee got comfortable again with the idea of selling the lake water and eventually came forward with a plan that will be cheaper for Waukesha residents than buying from Oak Creek would have been.
Speaking at a press conference yesterday, Milwaukee Common Council President Ashanti Hamilton had this to say about regional cooperation.
I'm just here to say there's a stronger region now because of this water agreement. And as we go forward, I think this can be one of the major examples that we can tout about how our communities can work together for a mutual benefit.
And Chuck, regional cooperation between Milwaukee County and a county like Waukesha County, they're mirror opposites politically in a lot of ways. Do we see a lot of cooperation between those two units of government?
Well, years ago, there was a lot of talk about the 124th Street divide. 124th Street is the boundary between much of Milwaukee County and Waukesha County. But there has been some thawing and some cooperation over the years. I think Milwaukee and Waukesha County cooperate now on some recycling projects. There have been other things that haven't gone as well in terms of racial issues. As you say, the partisan divide is quite strong between Republican Waukesha County and largely Democratic Milwaukee County, but Common Council President Hamilton and others think that this could lead to some additional cooperation.
Talking to Chuck Krumbach from WPR News about a new contract between the cities of Waukesha and Milwaukee for Milwaukee to be the source for Lake Michigan water going to Waukesha. Now, Chuck, there is a whole lot of backstory to this diversion request to get water from Lake Michigan. Can you give us some of the history behind it?
Well, yes, it has been at least 15 years. Mayor Riley of Waukesha talked about yesterday. There was this multi-state agreement, an international agreement, really, over the issue of whether places like Arizona would get lake water from the Great Lakes as things dry up elsewhere in the South and Southwest. So the states got together in the Midwest and came forward and agreed on setting these restrictions, setting what they say is a high bar to getting lake water outside the Great Lakes Basin. And they came forward with this, and it was signed in 2008. Waukesha came along eventually, as many people thought it would, to become the first community in the straddling county, part of Waukesha County's in the Great Lakes Basin, straddling county to get lake water. And so here we are. The compact approved Waukesha, and now Waukesha has a water source in the city of Milwaukee, so it seems.
And talk about Waukesha's groundwater, which is really the thing that set this all in motion.
Right. Of course, they've had radium problems, a contaminant radium, potential cancer causer. They've got some, have periodically had some supply issues in their groundwater. And they have said repeatedly, Waukesha has, that they cannot get reliable groundwater from elsewhere in Waukesha County, that additional filtering and so on to keep out radium is not as good an alternative as the sustainable word is the often used sustainable supply from Lake Michigan. And Milwaukee, which has a large water supply system, many years has had declining needs, or had at least a slump from years ago as people become more efficient with water or industries like big beer companies move out. So Milwaukee has this excess capacity and is quite happy, it appears, to sell Lake Water West.
A concern was that, hey, if Waukesha gets this deal, other communities, other places will get water. But you mentioned that concept of the straddling county. So Waukesha County is partly in the Great Lakes Basin. Waukesha, the city, isn't. But because they're in a county that straddles that border, they are eligible to apply for this exception, this diversion, where, as you mentioned, a state like Arizona, clearly not a straddling state here.
Right. There is still this, you mentioned the question, this issue of will Milwaukee water, Lake Michigan water, fuel more business development in Waukesha County. The Milwaukee Common Council nearly unanimously voted for this water sale. There was one alderman, Nick Kovac, who remains concerned that water from Milwaukee will fuel Waukesha County growth. Alderman had a long discussion that I attended a couple weeks ago, but unanimously voted for it. I would just say that yesterday's signing agreement was at the Waukesha County Business Alliance, which is not only happy to have water, sustainable water for its existing businesses, but maybe for future businesses as well.
And there were so many different stages in Waukesha's application. Are there any challenges expected out there, or hurdles, or is this just going to happen?
Well, it seems it's going to happen. There are permits to get from the state and local communities. Waukesha has to build pipes to bring in water from the western part of the city of Milwaukee. And, of course, there's the issue of return flow, though under the compact, Great Lakes Compact, the water has to go back to Lake Michigan. And there's still the plan to send the treated wastewater from Waukesha to Franklin and then down the Root River into Racine. There are some in Racine and Great Lakes mayors around the area that would like to not have the return flow go down the route. But for now, it appears that plan will still go ahead. Waukesha says it's cheaper than sending it back to the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. But there could be some developments on that. In any case, these permits and construction and so on is going to take several years. It might be 2023 before the actual water comes west and the treated wastewater goes southeast.
I want to touch on another southeastern Wisconsin water story that you're following, Chuck. You talked to the Racine Water Utility today about Foxconn plans, this huge plan to build a Foxconn technology plant there. It's going to use apparently a lot of water. What did you find out?
Well, Foxconn would be developed, the factory would be built in the village of Mount Pleasant. Much of Mount Pleasant is in the Great Lakes Basin, so no problem there, supposedly getting water to the factory. But part of the village is not in the basin, and Mount Pleasant is going to be asking, via the Racine Water Utility, asking the state to approve a straddling community diversion, one that only requires state approval, not from the other Great Lakes states, because they need to have water go to all the factory, if you will, including the part that's not in the basin.
So that just takes state approval? Is it because it's not in a straddling county, but in a straddling community? Do I have that right?
Right. And further complicating things is the town of Yorkville wants in on this. Yorkville is a nearby community to Mount Pleasant, and they're perhaps thinking that they're going to get some Foxconn-related projects. They want part of their town that's not in the basin to also be able to get lake water. And again, Racine Water Utility would be the supplier to Yorkville and Mount Pleasant, so they're the ones, Racine is, that's going to be asking the state DNR.
Do we have estimates about the scale, the volume of water that Foxconn would consume?
Well, seeing Water Utility today wasn't sure. They say that the projected numbers keep changing. It could be well into the millions of gallons a day, at some point. We're talking several thousand jobs to begin with at Foxconn, maybe 13,000, says Governor Walker. So it could be in the millions of gallons a day, it's a big bite that the state would have to review.
Who would be the decider if they applied, or if and when they apply for this water permit?
Well, the projected timeline is that the application would go to the DNR by the end of next month. The DNR would take 90 to 120 days to decide, and they'd be looking at things not only water supply coming in, but also something called consumptive use to make sure there wouldn't be a lot of water lost in the manufacturing process, that pretty much as much water that goes back, that comes from the lake, would go back to the lake, and it would go back through the Racine Wastewater Utility, it would seem.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Krumbach, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He's based in Milwaukee. He joined us today for some water coverage. We talked about the news that Milwaukee will sell water from Lake Michigan to the city of Waukesha. The mayors of those cities signed the contract yesterday. Also a check-in on the water needs of the Foxconn facility on its way in southeastern Wisconsin. Many families celebrate the holidays, maybe with a trip to the theater. But these performances aren't always comfortable for young people with autism, who can be hypersensitive to the loud music and bright lights of a concert or play. A growing part of Wisconsin's entertainment community is offering sensory-friendly events geared toward people with autism and their families, including the Milwaukee Ballet, Milwaukee's First Stage Children's Theater, the Madison Children's Museum, even some local mall Santas. Tonight in Milwaukee, First Stage offers a sensory-friendly version of a Charlie Brown Christmas. Emily Levine joins us now. Emily's the executive director of the Autism Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this was a new concept for me. Can you tell us what's involved in a sensory-friendly performance?
Sure. Well, autism is a brain-based disorder, and one of the things that we know is that a lot of people with autism experience the world in a different way than a lot of us do. So things like sounds and lights and the way the tags on their clothes feel affect them very profoundly. So in things like theater, where there are a lot of unexpected sounds and things happening that might not be normal with lighting, it can be very anxiety-provoking for our families, and they're worried about, is my child going to be comfortable? Is my child going to sit through this performance okay? And what's involved in a sensory performance is, first of all, preparation. What First Stage has done, which we really appreciate, is they have reached out to us and allowed our families to attend these programs with some advanced preparation. So there's a social story that's involved. And what that is it's just a picture-based story that talks about going to the theater and getting your ticket and finding your seat. Everything that's involved in a performance that is going to reduce the anxiety beforehand so that people know what to expect. And then in the show itself, there are warnings if something loud is going to happen, and there's some fidget bags that they have so that people can have something to fidget with while they're sitting so that they can get some of their nervous energy out. And then there's accommodations. If somebody has a need to get up and move around, they can do that, and there's a quiet space that they can go to if they just need a little break. So all the things that you would normally not want in a theater presentation, like someone getting up and walking around or leaving in the middle of an act, those kinds of things are okay in a sensory performance. And then what they have, like, cards that they can hold up, something loud is going to happen so that people can expect what's going to happen without worrying about being surprised.
Is this something where, for a show with that isn't sensory friendly for many people with autism or families with autism, it might just be off the table for them? They might not be able to go and check out something in a theater?
Yes. So what happens a lot of times is take our kids with autism and our other kids to lots of different things. And frequently, if you have a child that has an unexpected reaction to something that's happening or who suddenly feels uncomfortable and needs to leave, it can be embarrassing for the family. And a lot of us have experienced even getting kicked out of theaters or getting kicked out of movies because our kids are fidgety and sometimes make unexpected noises. And so these types of things are accepted in this. It's an accepting environment, so people don't have to worry that they're going to have to leave in the middle.
And this production tonight is a Charlie Brown Christmas, as you mentioned. This is first stage. Did they work with you or other organizations or experts to make sure they made this as sensory friendly as they could?
They have. They have done a really nice job of bringing in consultants, including some on my staff, but also other community consultants to help, so that the actors know what to do, and that the whole place is geared to be accepting and welcoming to people with all different types of disabilities.
And as I understand it, this isn't the first sensory-friendly show in Milwaukee or Wisconsin, for that matter. This is something that groups are starting to pay attention to.
Yeah, you know, about 10 years ago, our national organization, the Autism Society of America and AMC Theaters, started sensory-friendly movies where families can go on a Saturday morning and they don't play trailers because they can't adjust the volume on the trailers. They downward adjust the volume on the movie, and they have some lights on, and they don't have the ushers come and tell people they have to leave if they make noise. So it's a something that's been going on for at least 10 years in Wisconsin. And then more and more other organizations have picked up on it. And it's really a way of thinking about it is access to the community for people who have sensory challenges. Just like if you use a wheelchair, you might need a curb cut and an elevator to get into a place. For our folks, that access piece is a little different, but the sensory piece is very important to feeling welcome and unafraid to go out into the community.
We're talking to Emily Levine, director of the Autism Society of Southeastern Wisconsin, looking at sensory-friendly performances. There's one going on tonight, First Stage in Milwaukee, a Charlie Brown Christmas. What is it like, Emily, for families the first time that they're able to go to a theater without some of the worries that they might have in a non-sensory-friendly performance?
It's a huge relief, especially if you have had that awful experience of being asked to leave someplace. That is just kind of scarring, I guess. It's humiliating, and you get unwilling to venture out again. Some of our families end up kind of isolated. They don't want to. It's just exhausting to have to deal with autism in the first place. And what we always say is that autism itself is part of the issue, but being unwelcome in the community for a lot of us is just as big of an issue as the disability. So the way people are treated can be as disabling as the neurological differences that our kids struggle with. So having that opportunity to go out into the community, knowing that accommodations are going to be there, and then knowing that people are going to be welcoming is really huge. So in addition to the sensory differences, just having the assurance that people are going to be understanding and kind and welcoming is huge.
Is this something that we're doing better at as a state or as a local community in your area, whether we're talking about performances or just everyday places of business, recognizing that people with autism are out there and we need to think about how we are providing a space for them?
Absolutely. A lot of disability organizations have been working for many years on autism awareness, and we want to move on to, now that we're aware of autism, what do we do about it? And we want our workplaces and our recreation, everything in the community to be welcoming to everybody, regardless of their ability levels and regardless of the support that they need. For some of our folks, they do perfectly well in regular shows and regular movies, and then some of our folks have higher support needs and might need some additional accommodations, like these sensory-friendly performances. So just because someone has autism doesn't mean that they need to go to a special show or a special movie. The goal is to have every place accessible all the time, but realistically, sometimes we have folks that need additional accommodations to be successful, and we want them out in the community and having the opportunities that everybody else has.
Yeah, it sounds like there's not a one-size-fits-all for everyone dealing with autism, but could it be that for at least some people going to the sensory-friendly show first and getting used to that experience, maybe there's a future next step where they can go to non-sensory-friendly shows, and since they kind of know more about what to expect, it'll be a little easier for them?
Absolutely. And we found that both with the shows and with the movies, that there's just anxiety about anything new. We don't know necessarily how someone is going to react if they have autism. And so new is bad, surprise is worse, is one of the rules we had in my house when my son was young. And it's kind of funny but kind of sad, too, because there's so much anxiety about what's going to happen. Am I going to be welcome? Am I going to be bullied? Are people going to be mean to me? All those things are part of your decision to leave the house or stay home at any given point in time. And we want our folks to have opportunities and experience the community in ways that are available to everybody else.
You mentioned that it can be isolating for families if they're not able to go out and do things like this. But it sounds like this is an event where there are going to be a lot of families with at least one person with autism at this event. I mean, you're bringing a lot of people together. People are in the same boat. Is it nice to have that social connection with other people who are working on the same issues you are?
That's absolutely right. I mean, the Autism Society, we are all about building community and helping parents find other families that are in the same boat and connecting people with autism to each other, even connecting siblings to other siblings so that they know that there are other people that are dealing with the same kinds of challenges, and we want them to find each other and be successful, you know, find other people that understand them and get what they're going through.
We'll leave it there. Emily, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Emily Levine, Executive Director of the Autism Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about sensory-friendly performances in Wisconsin. First Stage's sensory-friendly performance of A Charlie Brown Christmas takes place tonight at 7 in Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. From swashbuckling space cowboys and cars that turned into robots to pizza-eating turtles and talking teddy bears, the 1980s saw a boom that turned toys into multi-billion dollar industries. Tomorrow, Netflix is releasing a new documentary series called The Toys That Made Us. The series looks at the history and impact of some of the most iconic and important toy lines, including Star Wars, Barbie, G.I. Joe, Legos, and others. We recently talked to the creator of the series, Brian Volk-Weiss, who joined us on the phone from Los Angeles. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Well, what made you want to tell the stories behind the toys of the 1980s?
You know, it's one of these things where that happens rarely, but you can turn your hobby into part of your quote-unquote job. And I basically saved the toys I had played with and then started buying toys that I didn't play with. Now, these days, they call that a collection, so I guess I became a collector. So I have a huge toy collection, and, you know, I'm a TV producer, and one thing led to another, and we were able to, you know, sell the show.
And from the perspective of a consumer, a kid who's playing with a toy, the parent who's buying a toy, you know, they see it on the shelf, they buy it, that's the whole story. And you started digging, and man, in the design of these toys, how they came into being, the business behind them, there's a lot of backstory there, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to being a toy collector, I'm also a huge history buff. So, you know, at some point I started, you know, doing research with Google and Wikipedia and whatnot, and I realized, you know, even Star Wars and Barbie, which are probably the two toys where the most has been written down about them, there's huge gaps and lots of information is not out there. And that's Star Wars and Barbie. You know, we went to Japan, we went to Denmark, we shot in Mexico. We shot in five different cities in California. We went to 19 states. So we really tried to find a fun way to do a deep, deep historical dive into all of these iconic toys.
Brian, I'm not going to ask you to spoil any of the stories you tell, but is there a toy among the ones you featured that, you know, it just totally changed your mind or changed the way you think of that toy, knowing what you know now?
Absolutely. Every single toy had dozens of moments where I had goosebumps, and there were several times I was listening to interviews, and I actually teared up and cried. You know, there were toys like Star Wars, which I would say I probably have a PhD in, and then there were toys like Barbie where, you know, I didn't even get to the first grade. But, I mean, there was just one amazing story after another. And, you know, He-Man's another example of a toy that I did not play with when I was a kid, but I am now a huge He-Man fan, like, and I would say I'm obsessed with He-Man the same way I am with a lot of the other toys that I collect, which is a brand new thing for me.
I gotta ask this, Brian, because if you were a kid of my age, mostly a boy, maybe girls too, you've grown up with one just burning question that I've never had answered. How come my Star Wars guys couldn't bend their arms and knees, but my G.I. Joe guys could? Did you find that answer?
Yeah, we basically do answer that question in the G.I. Joe episode. Basically, Star Wars figures were revolutionary in many regards, but one of the ways that they were revolutionary was their size. Before Star Wars toys came out, most figures were 3 and 4 times bigger than Star Wars figures. And the reason why Star Wars figures were the size that they were was because from the beginning, and this was also pretty revolutionary, they wanted the figures to be able to fit in the vehicles. So, you know, long story short, you know, when it was time to do G.I. Joe and bring it back, you know, they were competing with Star Wars figures. So they had to find something that would make them unique from the Star Wars figures. That was the first thing. The second thing is, you know, G.I. Joe was basically born in the 60s. And the original inspiration for the G.I. Joe figures, the big ones, like the foot-tall ones, was those artists, you know, those little artists, wooden mannequins that they used to sketch.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know what
you're talking about. The original origin of, you know, the 12-inch G.I. Joe figures. So when the 80s G.I. Joe figures came about, they had to differentiate themselves from Star Wars, and it was kind of in the G.I. Joe blood to have a lot of those joints, and that's how that all happened. G.I. Joe!
I got to ask before I let you go, Brian, you've got a toy collection. You've filmed now all these different toys. Is there a holy grail out there, the toy you don't have yet?
Can I cheat and say there's several holy grails?
Sure.
Yeah, there's definitely, I want the G.I. Joe Whale, which is the hovercraft. There was a micro line of Star Wars figures right around Empire Strikes Back. I want one of the Millennium Falcons from the Micro line. And then also there was a Mego Star Trek The Motion Picture bridge that I've never even seen with my own eyes. And I want one of those very badly as well.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And the Masters of the Universe.
That was Brian Volk-Weiss, creator of the new Netflix documentary series, The Toys That Made Us, which debuts tomorrow. And we'd like to hear from you about your favorite toys at 800-642-1234. What was your favorite childhood toy, whatever era you grew up in? Maybe you were a kid during the great toy surge of the 1980s, or a parent. What were your favorites? What were you sick of? And is there a special toy this holiday season that your kids are begging you to buy? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So what is it that makes a toy an enduring classic? Chris Bench joins us now. He's the chief curator at the National Toy Hall of Fame in Rochester, New York. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we just heard about that new Netflix show on toys. I'm guessing, having talked to you before, Chris, this is the kind of show that's right up your alley.
It is, and in fact, I consulted early on with the producers.
Oh, you did?
And they took some of those backstories from us and then went off and did their production.
And what was it about the 1980s? It does seem, and maybe it's just because I was, you know, a kid then, but it seems like that was peak toy in some ways. What was it about the 80s era?
I think what had really broken the flood dam for toys to really issue forth were things like Star Wars that had proven to people in every form of media that the toys could make more money than the motion picture or the comic book or the TV show.
And let's give a listen to the movie Spaceballs, where they tackle this issue, these sort of Star Wars science fiction satire.
Merchandising, merchandising, where the real money from the movie is made. Spaceballs the t-shirt, Spaceballs the coloring book, Spaceballs the lunchbox, Spaceballs the breakfast cereal, Spaceballs the flamethrower. The kids love this one. Last but not least, Spaceballs the doll, me.
May the Schwartz be with you.
Only very slightly exaggerated there by now. And, you know, and now we have, you know, the Transformers were big in the 80s, and we're still getting movies about them, bigger and bigger movies about Transformers.
That's right. Now it's all one fluid pattern, from toys to media, from media back to toys. And one of the worries in the toy industry this year is that there will be a glut of characters, so many that people stop caring about them because there are just too many to get invested with.
Now, in the National Toy Hall of Fame, you inducted some new toys and games this year. And it's interesting, kind of the opposite direction in some ways, some classics, some real humble ones like the paper plane, which I love, and I'm famous for making my trademark paper planes around the office. Talk about the appeal of the non-merchandise toy.
You know, there is some throwback kind of motif going on in this year's inductees to the National Toy Hall of Fame. And one of the requirements to get into the Hall of Fame is that you have to have been on the market for at least 20 years. So that thins out the Hatchimals and the LOL toys that are so hot this year. It means that it forces our panelists who make the selections to look at toys that have shown proof that they can stand the test of time, that generation after generation can find play value in things like the paper airplane or the wiffle ball or the board game Clue.
And Clue, of course, did turn into a movie. I can't see a wiffle ball, the movie, being a big phenomenon. But these are things that, multiple generations have embraced. And that's the key to being a Hall of Fame level toy.
It is, and it's useful in a season where often parents, grandparents are scrambling for the hottest item, what just came out, what's getting heavy rotation in television commercials, in online unboxing videos. And it's nice to remind them that there are toys with consistent play value out there that might not be top of mind in all the hot lists, but are nevertheless ones worth remembering for now or for future play with your child, grandchild, whoever.
Yeah, I remember an older nominee for your Hall of Fame, Legos. You know, I played with them as a kid, and that was one I happily bought, and they've been sort of reinvented in some ways since I was a kid. But, you know, that's one I definitely, we had boxes and boxes of them and a few of them on the floor, and you step on them. But that's, kids play with them, then they introduce them to their kids 20, 30 years later.
That's right. We see a sort of 25, 30-year cycle. It's the 25th anniversary of Tickle Me Elmo, so he is back.
Really?
Again, because kids who grew up with them are now parents, and if you turned out all right, you often want your kids to have the toys that you grew up with.
We're talking about some of our favorite toys and some classics with Chris Bench, chief curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame in Rochester, New York. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your favorite toy from your childhood? Is there something, a game or a toy that you played with as a kid and then got for your own kids? And what are you seeing as the hot must-have items this holiday season when it comes to toy shopping? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take your calls and continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret, and we're talking about toys.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Transformers, robots in disguise.
Every day can be a Care Bear day. You can play in a caring way.
They'll fight for freedom wherever there's trouble. G.I. Joe is there. G.I. Joe.
My buddy, wherever I go, he goes. and the Masters of the Universe.
Star is into her Ferrari. What a dream. She's into driving with Ken to the party scene.
Ferrari. Star Trek. Star Trek.
Zach. Woo. Zach. He's a Lego maniac.
You are unwise to lower your defenses.
Only you can decide with Star Wars toys.
We're picking up our conversation with Chris Bench, chief curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame in Rochester, New York, talking about classic toys. You can join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Paul is on the line in Fort Atkinson. Paul, hi.
Hey, I'm just kind of wondering whatever happened to the old classic micro machines. In particular, I used to like the Star Trek micro machines. I don't know if anybody carries them anymore. I haven't seen them around.
Micro machines. That's not one on my radar, Chris. Maybe I was the wrong age. Do you remember those?
I do. We have examples of them in the museum's collection. They're about a fifth of the size of a Hot Wheels or a Matchbox, maybe even smaller. They were nice and inexpensive. They could fit in your pocket. They were great for all those reasons.
And is there something like that on the market now, a really tiny car like that or machine?
You know, I'm not thinking of cars, but there's certainly lots of little collectibles like Shopkins and things of that ilk that are really appealing to lots of kids, where you can collect the entire set and always need more and buy them in packages where it's a surprise what you find inside.
Paul, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Jim with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, I'm a kid of the 60s, and the classic toy, and it's still a classic toy, were Lionel O-scale electric trains. I still have the ones that my father gave me. They still run. And I took my kids to Harry Potter World, and J.K. Rowling, she sold the rights to the Harry Potter train to Lionel, and I have that. And so that was something that related to my children. And she sold her castle rights to Lego, another classic toy. But Lionel trains, I'd be interested in your guest comments about them.
Before we let you go, Jim, I mean, do you still have them up and running? I think we lost Jim a little bit there, only sort of hearing him. But Lionel Trains, that is a classic, Chris.
It is, and they got inducted into the National Toy Hall of Fame in 2006. They have proven such durability across time from early in the 1900s right up to the present. Of course, Jim proves the question I've always had with Lionel. Were you actually giving it to your child, or was this a gift for yourself?
And it's something, and that's something that both generations can play with. And, the grown-up maybe has as much or maybe more fun than the kid. Jim, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Kevin in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. A couple of my favorites, Spirograph and Light Bright.
Okay. These I both played with, Kevin. Chris, those are definitely classics, right?
They are, and both of them have been finalists for the National Toy Hall of Fame. They haven't been lucky enough to be selected, but I had great fun with a new Spirograph set that was sent to me earlier this year by a manufacturer promoting it. It is back in its original form that Kenner put out in the 1960s, and those kinds of op art designs are every bit as current now as they were 50 years ago.
Well, it's interesting because, Light Bright seemed kind of like a high-tech toy. It was, you plugged it in, it lit up, and now it seems maybe refreshingly low technology.
It's basically pixels that we play with on much finer scales than Light Bright allowed with those pegs.
Kevin, thanks for that call. We're talking to Chris Bench from the National Toy Hall of Fame, looking at classic toys. We go next to Molly in Baraboo. Molly, hi.
Hi. I think the toy I remember most from my childhood, which probably is not in your Hall of Fame, was a Magic Genie bottle.
A Magic Genie bottle?
Yeah, it was just like a Magic 8 Ball, in that you would ask it a question, but you would take the lid off the top and smoke would come out of it.
Whoa.
And then you put the lid back on and a little door at the bottom, you'd open it up and it would have your answer. And I'm sure it was toxic, and I'm sure it was a fire hazard, and my father had to fix it many times before it magically disappeared from my life.
You got some good advice from it, though, right, Molly?
Right, I'm sure I did.
Molly, thanks for the call. Yeah, I remember the Magic 8 Ball. I do not remember this Genie bottle, Chris.
I don't either, and I'm going to hit eBay as soon as we finish this interview and see if I can snag one for the museum's collection.
Yeah, thanks, Molly. And I was going to ask, actually, Chris, have things like eBay and other ways of buying stuff used online upped our toy game? We can maybe go back and find that toy we remember as a kid?
It's way easier. When you used to have to drag yourself around early on Saturday morning to garage sales, to flea markets, to antique shops, that was a lot of work. And now with just the tips of your fingers, you can scroll through so many options and really delve into those toys you had or the toys that you wished you'd had.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We go next to Todd on the line in Beaver Dam. Todd, hi.
How are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you got for us, Todd?
Say, one of the things, I grew up in the Apollo era, and I remember Major Matt Mason and having all of the Major Matt Mason figures, and I had to have the moon crawler, and then the sadness when you bend them so much and then their legs would break.
Oh, no. And how big were these, Todd? Were these like the old G.I. Joe size or smaller or bigger?
They were about, I'd say, about 4.5 inches tall.
Gotcha. Todd, thanks a lot for that. So he remembers Major Matt Mason, and I'm guessing that wasn't the only NASA-themed space toy back in the day, Chris.
But it sure got a lot of promotion. It was a Mattel toy. It was a competitor to G.I. Joe. And I know that I put Major Matt Mason on my personal wish list one Christmas. And Todd was a lot luckier kid than I was. I didn't get him.
Okay. Well, thanks. Glad you told us about him. We'll go next to Deborah on the line in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi.
Well, it's got to be Spirograph.
Another Spirograph.
I can still, when I doodle, still do the images by memory.
You mean without the spiral, like without the tool?
Yep. I mean, then it's not that difficult. But at an estate sale about 10 years ago, I bought a Spirograph product, and it was digital, and you'd like enter an image in with, it was like you had a little keyboard, and then you could do up to 7 images, and then you replayed it. It would be like you could make a rabbit jumping out of a hat. I don't know what it's called. Maybe the Spirograph guy or the toy expert there has heard of it, but it makes noises like it when you enter the image in.
Gotcha. Deborah, thank you so much for telling about that, a high-tech Spirograph. And, you know, I wonder, Chris, we've seen this big resurgence lately, or we did in adult coloring books. I could see Spirograph for grown-ups being just as big a hit, a nice relaxing thing, drawing and pattern making.
It is. In fact, I saw it in craft books and how-to magazines even a year or two ago saying, you remember this as a kid, now you can do it on your walls, you can print it on your sheets, whatever kind of craftiness you and your Etsy-based projects want to do.
Time for one more caller. Daniel is with us in Platteville. Daniel, hi.
Hi, I want to mention something about the Micro Machines. They still make them.
Oh.
When they came out with the new Star Wars Episode 7, they actually brought those back, and you can pick them up at some toy stores.
Daniel, thanks for letting us know. So Micro Machines do still exist, and I guess if you make any toy, you're going to make a Star Wars version of it. Thanks for that call. Chris, as we wrap up, is there a toy out there you feel maybe hasn't gotten its fair recognition in the pantheon of classic toys?
You know, the one that is currently the longtime reject from the National Toy Hall of Fame, it's been a finalist 6 times and hasn't made it in, is the Magic 8-Ball. So that goes along with Molly's Magic Genie Bottle.
All right. And can the public influence that decision if people want to lobby for a toy? Can they reach out to the Toy Hall of Fame?
They can. I keep telling listeners like yours everywhere, write your proposal on a $50 bill, send it to me, and I will take really good care of that nomination.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Chris Bench, chief curator at the National Toy Hall of Fame in Rochester, New York. Been talking about some of your favorite classic toys. You can keep sharing your favorite toys of all time. Email ideas@WPR.org. Will the 8-Ball make the Hall of Fame? Reply hazy. Ask again later. Today is the winter solstice, and for those of us on the northern half of this here planet, that means the days will stop getting shorter, and yes, they'll start getting longer ever so slowly. It all has to do with the way our planet's tilted and the way we rotate around the sun. A lot of people are happy about that. Michelle Good, technical director here at Central Time, are you happy to see the days start getting longer?
I am particularly happy to see the days getting longer. Sitting in this studio, we see the sun go away. We've got another couple hours to be here. By the time I leave, it is night.
Very dark.
I mean, it's night. When I woke up this morning and I heard it was the solstice, I did a little happy dance. I was like, it's getting lighter. It's getting lighter.
But the problem I have every year is, okay, yay, solstice. The day starts to get longer. It's really slow and imperceptible. Like, you kind of have to manage expectations this time of year.
But it is getting lighter, even if you can't see it.
Right. And do you use any kind of, like, lights or any of that stuff?
I do have a happy light.
Uh-huh. And in the office or at home?
It's in the office, but it's next to my
desk. You're never in the office
desk.
In the dark, though.
Yeah, I know.
I always think about it maybe next year and the summer solstice, as the days start to get shorter, maybe I'll start to think about light then. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.